No, it's fine. I'm trying not to get distracted by the hordes of random shit around me.
But you did get through the first bit of sorcery eventually, I take
it?
I did. And the rest of it.
I got through the whole book yesterday.
General impressions?
Like I said, I enjoyed it more than I was expecting to. I don't remember enjoying it in the past, but I think that's because I was put off by like Fantastic and Colour of Magic and didn't really like Rincewind stories. And yeah, it does bear a bit of similarity to like Fantastic.
It does, yeah, just in its general adventure-y, magic-y theme. And
I think it is a good one, but it, because it falls between two very good ones, it sort of loses something.
What's next?
I was just checking, but because of the copy I've got, it doesn't actually say.
Yeah, same.
Because this is...
We've ended up with the same one this time. I think this is first edition paperback.
Yeah, hang on. Let me use the Google.
This book does not contain a map. Please feel free to draw your own.
Right. Can you see slash hear me?
Yep.
Sorry. Yeah, so Weird Sisters is next. So this falls in between two that I really, really, really love, which might be why I've disliked it in the past. But just looking at it for its own merits.
Getting to the witches.
And lampooning Shakespeare.
Yeah, I mean, just on its own merits. I mean,
it is
clever. It's cleverly written. I've never, you know me, I've never quite understood why the wizarding books aren't particularly popular. And there is slapstick humour in here and like easy digs and things, but it's, I don't know. I think
what
the character building is very vivid, and the metaphors are very good. And the,
I think what I've disliked about the wizard books in the past is that the stories can, the structure of them can be a bit funny, and it can make them a bit hard to follow. Like, there's not always a clear villain and the beginning, middle, end. It can get very muddy, like, especially with Colour of Magic and, like, Fantastic. But I think also because they were the first ones I read, and I read them when I was a bit younger, because, like, I really enjoy The Last Continent. Out of the wizard ones, that's probably my favourite.
Yeah.
But I think I enjoy the characters more when they're turning up in other books.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like, moving...
Little cameos.
Yeah. Or, like, so Moving Pictures is arguably a wizard book, because there's sort of two storylines going on, and one is very much focused on the wizards, and that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's, that's a good point actually, when they are a B plot.
Yeah,
or not really a B plot, even, it's like two A plots in Moving Pictures, isn't it? No, it's a B plot.
Yeah.
The Science of the Discworld is the same. I don't know how into those you are. There are four. Did you know that there are four?
I'm aware.
I don't have the,
but I think I've only read the first one. We will do bonus Science of Discworld episodes at some point. That'll be fun. Cool. Right then.
Cool. So what's your... Oh, sorry, you go.
And I was going to say, should we make a podcast if you were going to ask something else first?
I was just going to say, how's your routine going? Because you're saying this week you were going to have a return to reality, kind of.
I'm slowly building back into it. So I've managed to do yoga every day this week, which for me is a very big achievement, because I'd got completely out of the habit. I've been for a walk and a run. The plan was to run every other day, so I should have gone for a run today, but I couldn't make time and do this, so I'll go for one tomorrow instead. I'm slowly starting to build more housework into my daily routine, because that really needs doing. I'm still not writing, though, probably because I'm playing PlayStation too much still, and my sleeping pattern is still a mess.
Is your body clock, like, setting itself to something, or are you just randomly sleeping?
I think it's the fact that I'm staying up too late, so my body clock is adjusted accordingly. I don't think that's my natural rhythm. I think that's playing too much PlayStation in the evening. I need to be stricter with myself about screen times and going to bed, because I don't want to get into a habit of going to bed at 1 a.m. and getting up at 10, because eventually I will have to go back to work and have to go back to getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. So this has coincided with Jack doing the farm full-time.
Yeah.
So weirdly, these couple of unstructured weeks have been the first time in forever I've had a structured go to bed at 10:30, get up at 6:30. Although, while we start getting ready for bed at 10 or whatever, I don't actually go to bed until quite a long time after Jack sometimes. You've frozen. You've frozen again. Fuck. Not a lot I can do about that. Now she's gone.
Hi.
Joanna's back.
I am. I'm moving into the living room in the hope that the internet will work better. So bear with me while I set up a new recording studio and move the vase of flowers out of the way.
I'm wearing really big trousers.
I'm wearing really big, I'm wearing normal size knickers.
Look. I'm wearing like normal clothes on the front, and then, hey.
Amazing. Beautiful.
I think he brought me these back from, I want to say, Malaysia, but it might have been Indonesia.
No, don't knock the microphone off the coffee table.
I was wearing quite tight leather style jeans, but why the fuck would I do that to myself if I'm going to be indoors all day?
I have found putting jeans on makes me like feel like I'm up for the day and the day has begun.
Yeah, that's kind of lying to myself, if I'm honest. I'm not up for the day. I'm not up to the day. Oh, where are we?
Should we make a podcast?
Yeah, let's make a podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we're reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. Spoiler light. Today is our discussion of part one of Sorcery, the fifth Discworld novel.
Yeah, we're doing it remotely again because of the ever-ongoing pandemic and the wish not to kill each other or each other's family.
Yeah, well, you say that with who I live with, like...
Hope you enjoyed our bonus episode, which I bothered to get around to 5 days late. Sorry, Joanna. which means it came
episode.
Out like 3 days before this one.
Something like that.
But anyway, that was our practice run at recording remotely, and hopefully we will do a good job. But if not, apologies in advance, because by the end of this, I won't feel like apologising.
Yep, I'm going to do one blanket apology for the day now and then try not to apologise for the rest of the podcast because I'm working on myself.
Now I've got that kind of automatic transcription thingy, the Descript tool, which, oh my God, that's going to make my life so much easier. They mentioned it on the Back to Work podcast, and I'm just so pleased it exists. But anyway, now I've got that, I can see just how much we are and sorry,
ooh,
which is not flattering. So let's try and avoid those filler words.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Like, really? So.
Like, I mean, kind of, yeah. We are ever so millennial.
On the plus side.
So Sorcery, what?
I know, I was just saying.
There's a plus side?
Well, because I'm in lockdown and I'm not, you know, buying avocados and lattes, I can now afford a 5-bedroom house, so.
Yeah, on the downside, the disintegration of civilization will mean that 5-bedroom houses are torn down by the mob.
Oh, yeah.
We're all going to have to live in 5-bedroom straw huts.
Okay, cool.
So Sorcery.
Yes.
Sorcery is a wizardry book. It was published in 1988. It was the first Discworld book to be a number one bestseller.
How was it?
In the UK. I would have assumed it was Maud.
Yeah, I would have.
It stayed in the top 20 for 3 months, which is pretty good for a sci-fi fantasy genre book for that time. And as you quite rightly pointed out, at one point it was being considered as the, what was it, fifth Discworld novel to be adapted. Which never happened, and it doesn't look like it will.
No, which is a shame, because I know you didn't like Colour of Magic and Light Fantastic, but I think the Sky adaptations are quite good, entertaining TV films in their own right, and I think this would have been a good one. But if it had been adapted, it would have been David Jason, and we've already talked about why that was bad casting.
I'm pleased it wasn't, because, as I said at length, I fucking hate English fantasy TV stuff, so... With the one exception for the animated Lord of the Rings, which never got finished, so...
Yeah, which is a shame. I don't mind...
It is, I used to watch films. That a lot. You don't mind
the Lord of the Rings films?
Well, no, because they were American and high budget.
Yeah, true. The less said about the Hobbit films, though, the better. We don't discuss the Hobbit films.
We did, we weren't. We weren't nice.
No.
So, do you want to summarise? Do you want to tell us what happened?
I will.
What happened,
Jay? Before that, obviously, note on spoilers...
Oh, yeah.
This is a spoiler light podcast, so major spoilers for the book we're on, Sorcery, for the whole book, although we'll try not to talk about the second 2/3 of it too much. But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series, and we're saving any and all discussion of the final book, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
Yay!
Right, where's my summary? A rustly foley. So, in the first section of Sorcery, we are introduced to the concept of a wizard cubed. Angry Ipslaw sneaks into the staff. He's leaving his sorcerer's son. The wizards are preparing for the election, Emma, new Arch-Chancellor. I don't know why I bothered with air quotes there, because this is audio.
It's all right. I think you pronounced them quite well.
In the university, the books are getting restless. The rats and bedbugs and gargoyles are leaving. Rincewind and the luggage join them, dragging the librarian along for the ride. A mysterious...
Rats and bedbugs and gargoyles, oh my.
A mysterious figure sneaks into the university as Coin the Sorcerer interrupts dinner. Said mysterious figure nicks the hat. Rincewind makes it as far as the pub as Coin wins a magical duel. The hat thief finds Rincewind. After a tavern fight, he discovers the hat can talk and the world is coming to an end. Also, said hat thief is rather pretty. The hat announces that they need to run away to Klatch. The wizards start getting frisky as magic pours in and Spelter and Carding start plotting. Coin, who believes Arch-Chancellorship is his destiny, redecorates the Great Hall. The patrician, Vetinari, gets teleported to the university and becomes a lizard as the wizards get megalomaniac. Oh god, right, no.
Ooh.
Let me try that again. The patrician, Vetinari, gets teleported to the university and becomes a lizard as the wizards get megalomaniacal.
Becomes a lizard as the wizards get megalomaniacal.
That's the one.
Yeah.
They start thinking about taking over the world.
Megalomaniacal.
Megalomaniacal. Sorry. Baracetan, Moxafrizi, Bentroniamycin. Rincewind, Conina, the hat thief, and the hat head for the high seas. Slavers appear to interrupt their holiday to Klatch. Unsurprisingly, Rincewind gets knocked out. The wizards redecorate the city and start throwing their weight around. Rincewind wakes to find himself and Conina unkidnapped. The same cannot be said for the hat, and Rincewind has little argument with his conscience. So that's part one.
Not a lot happens, really.
No, it's...
In the first part.
I'll probably talk more about this when we get on to the second and third parts, but this is a very, very well-structured novel.
Yeah.
We talked about the Freytag's pyramid thing in... way back, I think, in The Light Fantastic. And I think this book is such a perfect example of the setup, the rising action, the falling action, and denouement. And this is almost all set up, and we've ended the section just as we're getting into the rising action, which is everyone's taken their places.
Yeah. But it's set up with kind of enough action woven through that it's not interminable.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. There's just a brilliant kind of description of what's going on in the culture and the surroundings of the university, but also just little bits of the rats fleeing and the...
Yeah, which is a really nice tension builder, especially considering the... Arguably the antagonist. I'd say the book has two antagonists. I'd say Coin and the Hat are equally in that role. And they're
both for different Coin is the wizard's antagonist and the hat is Rincewind's antagonist.
Yeah. And then they sort of antagonize each other. It's an interesting look, especially if you...
The antagonist of your antagonist is my protagonist.
Brilliant. But it's a story that maps really well onto things like Freytag's Pyramid or The Hero's Journey or Dan Harmon's Story Circle, which I might try and map specifically this book and look at how the action fits in.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I think it's one of the more, like, having said I wasn't really looking forward to, it's one of the more narratively satisfying ones. And that's enough of me sounding like a pretentious wanker. No helicopters or loincloths in this one.
What a shame.
Mm-hmm.
So did you pick out a favourite quote?
I did. Let me find it. Sorry, I'm somehow surrounded by even more crap in this room. So my quote is from the very first page. Summer thunder rolled around the sandy cliffs. Far below, the sea sucked on the shingle as noisily as an old man with one tooth who'd been given a gobstopper. It's a short quote this time, rather than using that as an excuse to read out an entire page of the book.
Oh yeah, see, I've done that. But yeah, no, it's another beautiful non-poetic metaphor.
Yep. I've been trying to not always have my quotes being an introduction or a scene introduction or a description of the weather or something, because I was doing that a lot.
Yeah.
Because he writes it beautifully and then hits you with the non-poetic thing at the end. But I just really like the sea sucked on the shingle.
Oh, the sea sucked, Oh, that's a difficult one as well. The sea sucked on the shingle by the seashore.
I've been very much missing the seaside just because of the whole lockdown and the weather's getting nice and I'd really like to be on a beach.
You never
right
went
now.
To the seaside.
What do you mean? I never went to the seaside.
Well, it's not like you'd have been at the seaside this week.
No, that wasn't. I just because I know it's not an option in, say, the next month or so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense, yeah.
A slight longing. And I like the seaside when it's still slightly too cold to go to the seaside.
Yeah, me too. There's no other people. It's nice. I'm not really a lounging around on the seaside person anymore because I hate getting sand everywhere and I burn so easily and I have no wish to tan these days and all of that. So I love going for walks on the beach. As my dating profile.
I've heard you also like pina coladas.
Would prefer to lounge around on a patio a little bit further back from the beach where I can still see the sea.
Yeah, that's fair. Whereas I very much enjoy a lounge around on the beach because it's such a rare opportunity for me. And I like being out in the sun. Yeah. Favourite quote, Francine?
Oh yeah, I've got a super obnoxiously long one. So,
perfect.
Let's do that. It's kind of an example of what I briefly went on about. The beautiful atmospheric setups and character developments and just the intrigue, the political intrigue that is woven into this frankly ridiculous story.
Yeah.
That's when Hackerdley, who's the lawyer,
yeah,
basically, is talking about, oh, this is all against the law and law within an R and law, all of that, and Coin says, well, I'm not a wizard, am I? But I am well aware of the need for wisdom, foresight, and good advice, and I would be honoured if you could see your way clear to providing those much-valued commodities. For example, why is it that wizards do not rule the world? But, my child, we have domains beyond the ken of the temporal power. His eyes gleamed. Magic can surely take the mind to inner landscape of arcane. You squabble for power, said Coin sweetly, and yet, beyond these walls, to the man who carts night soil or the average merchant, is there really so much difference between a high-level mage and a mere conjurer? Hackerdley stared at him in complete and untrammelled astonishment. Child, it's obvious to the meanest citizen, he said. The robes and the trimmings themselves. Ah, said Coin. The robes and trimmings. Of course. Just fucking devastating. That whole lead up just to that one bam, murdered by words sentence. Yep. The robes and trimmings.
Of course.
Of course. Just, it's almost like he's a really good interviewer leading the wizard to kind of suicide by words. It's not even murder by words. Yeah. It's like, well, how do they tell the difference between these levels of incredibly important power that you all live your entire lives by? The trimmings.
Sequence. Sequence.
Yeah, sequence. Obviously, the grade of sequence. Yeah. But I that is my favourite example of what's done throughout, which is the building up and destruction of the pomposity.
Yes, it's,
which of course does come back in force, but
but it is a fun theme for the book. I love a devastatingly placed, of course.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. There's something about putting an agreement somewhere that's not quite sarcastic, but a little bit patronizing around the edges, that if you're
yeah,
an argument,
that this is what I expected of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it can absolutely destroy someone. It's brilliant. Sorry.
Mm.
Apparently I'm slightly megalomaniacal and vindictive myself today.
Mm.
So characters.
Uh-huh.
I'm mentioning this one first because the luggage is obviously present and gets a little origin story in the dedication. Mm-hmm. Which reads, many years ago, I saw in Bath a very large American lady towing a huge tartan suitcase very fast on little rattly wheels, which caught in the pavement cracks and generally gave it a life of its own. At that moment, the luggage was born.
Love it.
So that made me very happy. I don't really have anything else to say about the luggage. I just like its little origin story.
Yes, and I kind of like how Rincewind, oh, the devastating agreement almost, like, when Conina is saying, oh, it's horrible, Rincewind's like, yes, it is, isn't it?
So we meet Ipslaw the Red, who mm-hmm. cements my opinion that there is a certain type of wizard that is just a dick.
Is he a bit like the tree wizard?
Yeah, Billet, that's the one. Who I'm going to say turns up when the ants are fleeing the university. I'm assuming he's one of the ants. And Ipslaw is an obnoxious, well, staff, I suppose. He ends up in the staff. But Ipslaw is the wizard who ran away from the wizards not being allowed to fall in love.
Mm-hmm.
And had 8 children, 7 of which he drove out because they argued with him.
Yeah.
And then has had the 8th one. Of course, the 8th son of a wizard is a sorcerer. hence the entire book.
See, I feel more sympathy for Ip's Law, though, because he is an exceptional wizard. It's like when... it's like, oh, you know those that Bill Gates documentary that's on Netflix? Have you watched that?
No, yet? I haven't.
There is some flashbacky bits which show him being quite arrogant and obnoxious in various scenarios. And it's difficult not to sympathize with him because some people kind of deserve to be arrogant. Like, yeah, you are a genius and better than most people. I can see why you're arrogant. And that kind of applies to Ip's Law for me.
That's fair. He's still a dick.
It's not that I think he's a good person because of it, and he is a dick and would be horrible to be around, but it's like, yeah, now I get it.
Yeah.
It must be really annoying being in a world where everyone is stupid.
Yeah, right, fair point. I'll allow that. But when we meet Ip's Law, we also get to hang out with Death a little bit, which I didn't...
Ah, yes.
Considering I've always said this is one I wasn't looking forward to, two of my favourite Death quotes that, like, people reference when they talk about Discworld are in this section.
Yes.
So you've got, what would humans be without love? Rare, said Death.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing one. I meant, said Ip's Law bitterly, what is there in this world that makes living worthwhile? Death thought about it. Cats, he said eventually. Cats are nice. Who else do we meet? We've got the hat.
Mm-hmm.
Which I keep... I'm really conscious of saying now.
Yeah.
Fuck's sake.
Well, it's something we really should train out of ourselves, because, see, I've just done it now. If we were on radio or a live broadcast, we would sound like tits. So I think it is best that we try not to use filler words. When I used to do the occasional presentation for work, I was a bit better. I learned to pause instead of umming.
Excellent.
Which seems a bit more authoritative. Bill Bailey said that a pipe helps.
Oh, yeah.
But audio-wise, probably doesn't.
Also,
so you get to, you know, play with your pipe a bit, have a puff on it, which looks a bit more intelligent than going,
I'm not quite enough of a hipster wanker / manic pixie dream girl to become a pipe smoker. I feel like that'd be the final nail in the coffin of me being a manic pixie dream girl. Oh, I'm eccentric. I have a ukulele bubbles. And smoke a pipe.
Mm.
Yeah. And pick hair.
Yeah.
No, we're not doing that.
Mm.
Anyway, sorry. So we meet the hat. It was a good hat. It was a magnificent hat.
Mm.
Gold lace and pearls and bands of purest vermin. And but yeah, so the hat, we learn as we get through this section of the book, has actually got all the knowledge and wisdom of previous Arch-Chancellors sort of imbued into it and has become sentient in its own right. Hence, mm-hmm. encouraging someone to steal it and run away to Clatch.
Yep.
Which, like I said, the hat kind of becomes an antagonist by the end of the book, but right now it seems like it's just a sad little hat that's bored of being on a shelf and wants to go on an adventure, and I have a lot of sympathy for it in the first section.
I don't know. By the time we're at the end of this section, he's already, like, forced Rincewind to put it on and made them go on a terrible journey.
The hat is another arrogant dickhead wizard, but maybe I just have...
But your sympathy lies with him because of the... Yeah.
Mostly the sequence.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say the current situation with being stuck indoors, but the sequins makes sense.
Yeah, no, I tend to sympathise with particularly the sequined items.
Mm. I noticed no sequins on your person today, Joanna. I thought we self-isolated in sequins these days. Oh, you are shiny.
Yeah, my t-shirt.
That is a shiny patriarchy smashing t-shirt. Yeah. Okay,
also, great. I wasn't planning on taking any selfies today. I'm also not wearing makeup.
Are you not?
No, no makeup.
Your skin looks great.
Yeah, well, it turns out lockdown is pretty good for my skin.
I'm wearing an Alice band a lot of the time to keep my hair out my face because that stops me touching it so much.
I found myself popping a bandana on every now and then, but I think, honestly, that's just because I'm still in kitchen withdrawal. Miss my kitchen.
Putting a bandana on, covering your hands in flour and leaving handprints all over the place.
Well, the covering my hands in flour is because I've actually been making bread. Oh, I haven't seen...
Oh, yeah, that bread looked amazing.
Oh, my God, it's so good. Proper sourdough.
Have you had it?
Yeah, I've had a slice with whipped tahini butter.
Ooh.
Like I said, I really miss the kitchen.
Oh, I'm going to make bread later, I think. Fuck me, I haven't even planned dinner at all.
Ooh, I'm making burgers tonight.
I'm a terrible housewife.
Well, that's because you're not really a housewife, Francine.
Yeah, I know.
I am technically a housewife right now, but as my husband's also technically a bit unemployed around the ears. We're both housewives.
Mm.
I realised part of why I missed the kitchen so much yesterday. because normally when I'm working in the kitchen, while I'm on my own and prepping, I listen to podcasts. But then when I have other people in there, I have music on and we dance around and we sing. And
yes.
I haven't been listening to music and dancing around and singing at all, because every time I've been cooking at home, I've been listening to podcasts. And I suddenly went, oh no, I just need a big dance break and to sing loudly to something. So my plan is I have some more podcasts to catch up on, but then later tonight while I make burgers, I'm going to probably listen to the entire soundtrack of Cabaret or something. Anyway, yeah, sorry, that was a huge sidebar and not what we were talking about at all. Rincewind, we hang out with Rincewind in this book.
Yep.
Him and the librarian sort of get introduced in the library as the books start panicking. It's nice to see the librarian. It's always nice to see the librarian.
It is. And it's nice to see Rincewind and the librarian together.
I like that. I'm pretty sure this does happen every book the librarian features. There's a footnote explaining why there's an orangutan working in the library, because all the books work as really standalone. But I do like that in this particular one, it wasn't that he was unaware of the despair and nobility of the human condition. It was just that as far as he was concerned, you could stuff it.
Yeah, well, quite.
No, I feel like orangutan philosophy is something we could all buy into. There's a brilliant line later on with Rincewind. I think he's arguing with Konina or something, and he says something along the lines of, yes, I'm quite addicted to being alive.
Yeah, yeah. I got hooked on it at an early age. And
but because, like, we talked about when we talked about Colour of Magic and Light Fantastic, how Rincewind is sort of this bit of a nihilist.
Yeah.
It's quite nice to... Although he's a nihilist, he knows things are all going to go tits up for him and he's going to end up on this adventure he doesn't want to go on and what have you.
Yeah.
He's still very determined to survive through it. He's not completely resigned. He's resigned to this happening, but he's not resigned to, oh, this will happen and it'll end horribly for me and I'll die. He's sort of... There's a bit of him that is still very survival instinct.
Yes. Yeah, and yeah, he's a product of his environment, I think, and still has human in there. Like,
yeah,
I just found the bookmark I was looking for, which is the interaction between Rincewind and the librarian that I particularly liked when they're in the pub and already quite drunk, and Rincewind's telling him about the sorcerer in the book he had when he was little. And he was standing on a mountaintop waving his arms and the waves were coming right up and flashes of lightning. Ook, I don't know why they didn't. Perhaps he had rubber boots on. And then later, just a half then, ook, how do you pay for this stuff? Every time anyone gives you money, you eat it. Ook, amazing. Just the really good execution of the one-sided conversation.
Yeah.
While both of them are in the room. Like, it's that trope of the phone call, usually, one-sided conversations to shreds, you say.
It's a really hard thing to write. So last year, the monologue I was in for the theatre crawl we do every year, I was having to do one part of a conversation with these people I could see, but the audience couldn't. I was like a very posh woman at a wedding,
and we managed, yes, I remember, yeah.
And we had to build in this comedy of this mysterious Auntie Brenda that no one wanted to say hello to. And then the piece that I've mentioned on the podcast before that I was supposed to be performing this month, I'm now hopefully doing in September if we're allowed to have theatre again by then.
Squish, squish.
Sad face. So that another comedy magic shop monologue thing, I've had to write this character having interactions with customers that aren't there. So it's been quite fun trying to put a, well, yes, of course. Yes, no, you will be invisible. No, that's why you can't see it. It's invisible.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Because you still have to write, or at least have a rough idea of what the other half of the conversation is to be able to react to it. It's got to be a natural pause for someone to say something. It's really hard to act.
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't it, you'd think almost that the writer would put in the phantom lines.
I honestly don't know if he thought about it that much. I did for the piece that I'm going to be performing later in the year, because even before I knew I'd be performing it, I know what it's like to have done that, because I'm coming at it from an actor's perspective as well as a writer. But Art, who wrote the piece I was in, isn't an actor.
That is an interesting part of playwriting / acting that I had not considered
before. Yes, it's good fun.
The phantom lines is probably a word lines. For it.
Probably.
And if it's not the phantom lines, it should be.
Well, let's say that it is. I've decided to become a trendsetter. Sorry.
Yes, I thought in this book we met the bursar proper, but it's not, is it?
Spelter is the university bursar, but
he's not the bursar we know later.
Yeah, so mild spoiler for future books in that there is very much a Bursa character. Spelser is still one of the main characters of this book.
Yes, who is pretty good.
Yeah.
He's similar to what's his jobs played by Tim Curry. Help me out.
Trimen.
He's similar to Trimen in that he is the calculating calm.
But he's villain. He's kind of
similar to Trimen in the book, not in the fucking cake swirling shitty TD.
Well, you've got him and Cardin kind of doing this double act of, I wouldn't say villain. I'd say
he's villainous in the same way that all the wizards are villainous, in that he's calculating and murderous.
Yes.
But yes, you're right. He's the not very likable protagonist of quite a lot of it.
Yeah, and like, he's the kind of middle grade wizard, and you've got Cardin, who's the large to his
eighth.
Who's a seventh level, and I think he's like a fifth level.
He's eighth, isn't he? He's the eighth, I'm sure he's eighth.
Oh, maybe he is eighth. I'm trying to find where Cardin gets introduced now.
Maybe I'm thinking of what's his chops who got blown up, Bilius.
There's so many wizards.
Yeah. By the way, this doesn't really go anywhere else, but the line, "Ye gods, he blew Bilius away," has stuck in my head since I first read this when I was like a kid, and I don't know why. Just, "Ye gods, he blew Bilius away."
It's a fun line.
That is the line I think of whenever I think of the wizards.
So Carding's full title is Mamaric Cardin, Head of the Hoodwinkers, which I greatly enjoy. I will find the levels before we get to the end of this podcast, because I was going to talk about their grading a bit more. But they're sort of wizardly cat and mouse.
Yeah.
That they play with each other before coming to some sort of uneasy truce is quite entertaining.
Yeah. The idea of kind of going through the entire conversation in your head before starting it, I really enjoyed.
Yes, because I do that.
Yeah, but not in such a calculated manner.
No.
Like, I know we both do it, but we do it in a, how could I end up looking stupid here way, not in how can I come out on top of this indirection?
So that how can I come out of this looking stupid, or having arguments in my head to save me having the argument in real life?
Yeah,
because I can kind of get to my final point quicker when I then have the argument.
Yeah, that's why I prefer interacting with people via text.
Yeah.
Not SMS, or just like text format in any way.
Yeah, no, I much prefer that because I have time to think and construct responses. Arguing over the phone is
I'm on this page which is going to tell me which bloody level he's on. Yes, eighth, he is.
Oh,
bluntly, Cardin was surprised. He shouldn't have been eighth level wizards that seldom faced with challenging. So I'm guessing eighth is the top. It seems like it, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, that maybe it makes sense that there's eight levels.
Oh, eight.
Eight is the magic number. Thou shalt not say the number between
eight
seven.
Is the magic number.
Have you drawn any more octograms?
No, I don't want to accidentally summon anything when it's difficult to get the brown bin taken out.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So Coin, obviously, is our main antagonist-y type person for this bit, the sorcerer. So Coin is a baby at the beginning of the book, and his father, Ypsilor the Red, dies and puts himself into the staff, and the staff is watching over the baby. He's described as looking about 10 years old when he turns up in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was he doing? Like, because the staff can't, like, change a baby and feed it and stuff, so who was looking after him?
My guess is, like, psychically draw a caregiver.
I would assume something along those lines, and it could easily have not actually... I haven't looked at the L-space for this book yet, because I try not to in case I end up just plagiarising it. But we get an actual definition for sorcery as well, from Caps Lock's Complete Lexicon of Magic with Precepts for the Wise. Sorcerer. A proto-wizard, a doorway through which new magic may enter the world. A wizard not limited by the physical capabilities of his own body, not by destiny, nor by death. It is written that there were once sorcerers in the youth of the world, but not may there be by now, and blessed be, for sorcery is not for men, and the return of sorcery would mean the end of the world. So that establishes the stakes fairly thoroughly, I think, on page 68.
Yeah, so this seems like a good point to this. Pratchett spells it with a U and nobody else does. This isn't like a British spelling or anything. We spell it with an O-R. Well, I thought so, because I kept writing it S-O-R.
No, so we spell it S-O-R. It's source with a U because he's the source of magic.
Right.
Since
Like if we're, this is why, like if it's spelled properly, it comes from sores, which is Latin for lot or fate, and that's lot in like your lot in life, or yeah, like drawing from a lottery or something like that. So something you don't have any control over. Yeah, so it's quite cool.
But yeah, I think it's spelled with a U because it's meant to be the word source.
Okay, that does make sense. But I honestly thought it might just be a weird old fashioned / misspelling whatever thing, because that is a pun in the title.
A pun or a play on words. So, next character we are introduced to is Konina. I didn't prepare like a whole PowerPoint presentation.
Cool.
On feminism. Let's just
go.
We'll start with an early description. Of course, Rincewind had been around a bit and had seen a thing or two and had thrown off his early training to such an extent that he was quite capable of spending hours at a time in a woman's company without having to go off for a cold shower and a lie down. But that voice would have made even a statue get down off its pedestal for a few brisk laps of the playing field and 50 press-ups. It was a voice that could make good morning sound like an invitation to bed. The stranger threw back her hood and shook out her long hair. It was almost pure white. Since her skin was tanned golden, the general effect was calculated to hit the male libido like a lead pipe. So Konina's hot, and
in a very specific.
Yeah. And if we look at
I guess we know what Pratchett was into now. That's
he's got a type. If we look at the one thing I'll say for the not very feminist and incredibly cartoonish colour illustrations that we've talked about a lot before, Josh Kirby. Doing his, I love the Josh Kirby illustrations. I do, but and she's got great thighs. I'll give you that.
Yeah, I'm always up for a bit of muscular.
I like a tree trunk thigh. I'm just going to remind everyone of this quote from Pratchett's Women by Tansy Rayner Roberts. I have read this out on the podcast before, but I think it is particularly relevant here.
Bears repeating.
In these early Discworld books, we find Pratchett mocking the semi-clad, bosomy fantasy women who traditionally reward the handsome hero with their sexy selves. He did this at first by creating semi-clad, bosomy fantasy women who A, say bitchy things to the not handsome hero in the hopes that no one would notice they're still a cliche of the genre, and or B, amusingly fail to fall in love with the protagonist, but instead choose to reward a less obvious male character with their sexy selves. But I think that quote is definitely relevant here with Konina, who is...
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
But the thing is,
does she fall in love with someone in this?
Yes. We'll get there.
Cool.
Part 2 and 3.
Nice.
The thing is, I don't dislike Konina that much as a character, because, like, on the one hand, less the blonde and beach ball bosoms, but she's a woman who's very competent with weapons, and as I've said before, this is, you know, my type.
Yeah, but...
But it is still a very not well-rounded female character who is to an extent there for eye candy. And I feel like there's even less of an excuse for her here than there was in Colour of Magic. In Colour of Magic, it was such a parody of the genre that Liesa kind of did work, arguably, is it?
It's kind of, to me, relying on the, isn't it funny that this beautiful woman is also good at fighting?
Yeah. And I think that joke is quite funny the first time it happens, and by the end of the book is overdone.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, it's repeated in every scene with her in, kind of thing.
Yeah, and
she pirouettes in her pretty dress and kicks somebody in the
unmentionables.
We get it. The contrast is amazing.
But also the whole
give her a personality.
The joke of like her entire personality is I don't want to be a barbarian. I want to be a hairdresser. And there's something there's something in mocking a stereotypically female profession. Like, isn't it funny that she can do all this fighting, but she just wants to do pretty hairstyles?
Yeah, I feel like hairdresser was picked because of the blades thing.
Yeah, no, I can see the logic.
I would have gone with chef.
See, chef would be much better because it's still...
It's not the stereotypical, yeah.
It's not a stereotypical girly thing, and we won't get into misogyny in the fucking cooking industry. That's a whole other PowerPoint
we'll get there
presentation.
Another day. Yeah. I've run out of purple post-it notes, Joanna. I'm sorry.
I did actually put in the show notes purple post-it time.
I noticed. I like it.
But I do quite like the nature versus nurture argument it brings up of, you know... She wants to be feminine. She wants to be stereotypically feminine in a hairdresser. And some of that is to an extent, I think, that she's sort of written as wanting to find a boyfriend and men aren't really into women with sinews like tree trunks, or however she describes herself.
I definitely sympathize with some of it, because there's a lot of stereotypically feminine things I would have liked to be, certainly when I was younger, that just my general lack of coordination, the fact I was very tall, very young, and all of that stuff kind of made me feel not feminine in ways, and I kind of get that feeling through.
Yeah, and as someone with a barely passing relationship to gender at this point, I like her grappling with
but we can remember when we cared.
I like her grappling with traditional gender roles and wanting to be more girly than she can be, because she's got this hereditary barbarian hero-ness.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it raises interesting questions about nature versus nurture.
Yes.
I don't have answers for
them. And I think it's a shame that more time was spent on tropes than on that part of her personality.
Yeah, I think if it had investigated her relationship to having the barbarian hero father a bit more.
Mm.
Partly because I love Cohen.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, we just want more barbarian in everything, don't we?
I would like there to always be a couple more barbarians just in life.
If only so you could justify the existence of the loincloth segment.
We'll get there. We will get there.
I know.
It'll get a bit loinclothy.
And then the other main character is Vetinari, of course.
Yes, who's not...
Enter Vetinari,
which is I'm excited about. He's not really a main character in this book, because he spends almost the entire book as a lizard.
Well, that's true, but he's a main character in the
series.
Discworld
this books. Is something we've sort of danced around every time a patrician character has featured, although so far not been named. Because we were excited to actually get to meeting this character. So I'm glad he's finally here and named and is Vetinari, because...
Yes. The patrician. Underline.
Vetinari. He's one of my favourite characters in the entire Discworld.
Not so much a reign of terror as a shower, the occasional shower.
Yes. Sorry, I'm trying to find the description. He's thin, tall, and apparently as cold-blooded as a dead penguin. And he's great because everything about how he's described and the way he's introduced, he should be a villain. He looks like he's stroking a white fluffy cat, and he's a tyrant, but he's a benevolent tyrant, and he's not particularly villainous apart from having the scorpion.
He looks like he might use the word exquisite.
Yes.
Ankh-Morpork is the one location.
Yeah.
Well,
it's the main location for the first section, and as always, we get some lovely descriptions of the murky Ankh River. And of course, by the end of this section, Ankh-Morpork gets cleaned up and the river is bright and sparkling and the market square gets a bit of magic attacking it. Which actually, joking about Ankh-Morpork characters in isolation, once the wizards start kind of throwing their weight around and redecorating the city, it's really quiet and everyone takes to their homes. It is very much like the isolation town right now.
Unseen University kind of becomes part of the city in a way it wasn't. It's like they were two separate locations to start with, and now they're not by the end of this section.
Yes, it sort of flows itself out into the city.
Yeah, because Unseen University, as I believe we covered in, I want to say Light Fantastic, is its own entity. So it's not even a location so much as a character in ways, and yet it's been very rudely disrupted in this section.
Yeah, it's equal rights where Granny discovers that she can actually borrow the building. And it's almost like a large friendly puppy, which involves wizard patting the building stones and saying, "There, there." Right. Little things we liked, Francine. Yeah.
You go. You've got a thing. You've got
one. I have got one. I promise I'll stop talking about the kitchen, but there's a food description that made me smile. In the vaulted maze of the kitchens, while the imagination should need no assistant, it should include lots of grease and heat and shouting, vats of caviar, whole roast oxen, strings of sausages like paper chains strung from wall to wall. And it just made me smile. I like the thought of the bustle and everyone pulling this giant feast together and the head chef inexplicably carving a swan out of butter.
I know, I did love that. Nobody had the heart to tell him to stop. It was the university, a scale model of the university out of butter.
Oh, yes, it was. But it mentions, like, such a swan. Whole rancid, greasy, yellow menageries.
Yeah. It's very evocative.
It is incredibly evocative. I can see it melt.
Butter sculptures are a thing, aren't they? And clearly he is as disgusted by the thought as I am.
I always thought it was kind of taking the piss out of ice sculptures, which, again, why? Why would you bother with an ice sculpture?
I think it's probably one of those terrible rich people things that look how much money I can afford to waste on something so transient and pointless.
Yeah, like it's just, you've just spent a lot of money on water and someone's time.
Well, I mean, if you're going to say that, you can say, oh, you just spent a lot of money on a bunch of pigments splashed around a bit of paper.
All right, fine. I still, I feel like eye sculptures are the epitome of why everything is bad about late stage capitalism.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Yeah. Cool. So we also get a reference to the Necro Telecomnicon.
Yes.
Which just made me smile because I kind of assume this must have been written around the same time as Good Omens, just because there are a couple of similarities, especially with how some characters are written. And then it had the Necro Telecomnicon as well, which isn't the first time that's been mentioned in a Pratchett book, as well as being in the Good Omens. We also have, as all the animals start running away from the university, the rats are described as wearing clothes. But that wasn't unusual for the university. And we'll come back to that in about 30 books' time.
Yay! Jesus. Oh, there's so many books. What have we done? So many books.
So many books. But yeah, so that made me smile.
Yeah, the next bit I noticed was when I was talking about the Mage Wars.
Yeah.
I thought it's kind of getting a little bit Tolkien around the ears here. Like, we know Pratchett's a massive fan of Tolkien, and it just reminds me of reading The Lord of the Rings specifically, and it's kind of vague, ominous mentions about the earlier ages and the huge wars that shape the landscape and that kind of thing. And I know that it goes into detail about it in The Silmarillion, but it shouldn't have. And I like,
I feel like a lot happened in The Silmarillion. But...
yeah, we'll pretend it didn't. Yeah. Well, we'll pretend it did not get published, because frankly it shouldn't have, and I believe Tolkien would not have done so.
Yes. Anyway, sorry.
But yeah, I remember loving the kind of vague...
hints to what had gone before.
Hints, yeah. Mm. Of huge cataclysmic events that... It's the part of me that just fucking loves post-apocalyptic literature, and that it's the before times, the event.
I do like books like that where they just hint to this huge, rich history that's come before and don't deeply go into it because they don't need to. One that I think sort of does it quite well... not quite in the same way, but Sam Sykes, who's a really good American fantasy writer, who I like a lot because his books are always a bit violent and a bit sweary and a bit funny. And his book, The City Stained Red, sort of comes in. All the characters have already met and are a merry band of misfits. And their whole backstory...
Oh, that's nice. That's quite unusual, isn't
it? Yeah, and their whole backstory and how they've got to where they are and everything about them. Like, hints of it are revealed throughout the book, but... a lot of the history is already taken place, and the book doesn't assume you need to know that much more of it, so it just gets on with the story, and it's a very fun story. They're very he's a really good writer. I highly recommend his books. I think I've mentioned them on the podcast before.
Yeah, I must say, I'm gonna slightly disagree with myself a second ago in that saying I do like a little bit of explanation as well towards the end of something. Like,
it's nice to have a bit of...
Did you ever play the Horizon Zero Dawn game?
No, I didn't get around to it.
That's kind of a post-apocalyptic thing, which does a nice reveal explanation of what happened near the end. But I like the detail of The Silmarillion was just fucking horrible.
Post-apocalyptic.
I like stuff being explained to me, but I don't like... I also like the lead up and the hints and the vagaries.
I think the problem with post-apocalyptic fiction is something has to have happened for the world to get like that. And a lot of those books do end with a big, and this is how.
Mm.
And that can be a very, very good plot twist, or it can be a very handy, it was Earth all along.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think when it's done well, it's great. But when it's not done well, it's painfully bad.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Agreed. The next one's me as well. So this is when Coyne is like, this is all weird and old and ugh, and does a little bit of a makeover.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the Queer Eye guys, I think.
Are you saying Coyne is basically Burke?
Yes.
Okay.
You disagree? No. Does Bobby Burke not also have the golden-eyed stare that fixes 6 inches below the back of your brain?
Oh yeah, good point.
Or am I imagining
I think he kind of does. Out of the Queer Eye guys.
Yeah, so Ross...
Sorry, he's just the one I least want to disappoint. Like, I reckon I could cope with Karamo being kind of annoyed at me because, like, he's just intense all the time anyway. Whereas I think if I let Bobby Burke down, I'd never quite be able to forgive myself.
Yeah, he's very easygoing, but yeah, imagine disappointing him. That's a really good point. Anyway, raw sunlight streamed into the hall for the first time. And it is very unforgiving, and it shows like everything has been threadbare and nicotine stained. And this reminds me of two things mainly. The first being today I noticed that we are now at the point of spring where the sunlight starts hitting things in the house at odd angles, and you realize there are some objects you have not cleaned in far too long.
Yeah.
So today I cleaned the doors, for instance. And second reminds me of pubs, old tatty English pubs that you hang around in the evening, and then if you work in one, or if you know people who work in one, you go in the morning in the bright unforgiving sunlight.
Oh, God,
and it
yes.
is all threadbare velvet and grease and everything, and I feel like that's what Pratchett's been inspired by here.
I can definitely see that,
you know, the booths and the bleh. Yeah,
beer stains on everything.
Yeah, I just thought that was a nice clever, again it's just one paragraph, but it just throughout I fucking such a really good setup. It really is.
It takes its time with describing all of these tiny little moments, and it's considering there's quite a lot to set up. This is almost, you know, a setup of pins, and so the second act is the bowling ball going down, and the third act is the pins being knocked over. Ha! Metaphor. Get me.
Yeah. And there are loads of like little moments about Coin as well that just kind of set him up as superhuman. Like when they say, like his eyes were like the, he didn't say lizard, but he said something like reptiles basking on a stone, and like he said his smile was like the smile on the face of a moon.
Yes.
And everything, and it's just, it's all very ooh,
especially
not chilling exactly, but it's like he's almost a deity figure.
Yeah, because he's more, but he's not just a straight villain like the way
he's not, I wouldn't say he's a villain at all. He's a child with incredible power.
Yeah. It's like when you let...
Which, yeah, I guess, villain. But
at the same time, he's got that kind of childlike innocence to him. This is more stuff I'll talk about in the last section, though. One thing I really enjoyed is the Patrician's ban on street theatre and mime artists, because I...
Did you? Because I feel like this is going to be your ticket to a scorpion pit.
I don't like... I don't really like street theatre. It's awkward.
But I feel like you would be probably persuaded to do
it. Oh, I probably would. We've talked about doing it with my theatre company, but I don't like being around it. I don't...
Forced participation.
Or
even just being chivied into participation is very...
Yeah, even if there's no audience participation, it's just terrible. Watching. There's something about the moment of walking past and not engaging, and you can see the disappointment in someone's eye, because I've had to do like street canvassing and stuff, and there's, you know, they bear relationships, but also there's something about the forced jollity of it all and the distraction, and it can be so aggressive because it's so stressful for the performer as well, that you feel obligated to be a part of it. And I don't like a sense of obligation, especially for something I've not, you know, bought a ticket for. And like, if you ever tried walking through Covent Garden on a busy day with an easily distracted teenager?
No, I was one, but...
Well, an easily distracted really teenager since. And a 39-year-old magician.
Oh, God.
You stop and watch a lot. And to be fair, it's generally very good and very entertaining. Eddie Izzard got started doing street theatre and doing escapology on an 8-foot unicycle.
Of course he'd fucking do it, Jesus.
God, I love Eddie Izzard. Like, I'm not saying that it's...
It sounds like something ridiculous he would say to demonstrate something else, but that was literally his origin story. Yeah. Amazing. Yes.
Very much so.
There's something about street theatre as well that kind of... Part of the magic of theatre, I think, is its separation from the real world. You're going into this special place for it, and everything's contained in this magic little stage, which is somehow also an entire world in itself.
Yes.
And
admittedly, sometimes
sticking it out in the unforgiving sunlight.
Yeah.
And
you can see the patched up
making it all weird. Yeah. Which is kind of how it's almost how I feel about this kind of like the low budget TV fantasy stuff. It's like, don't, because you can't do it well. Like, have a high enough budget to make it all nice and smoothed over, or don't bother, because... Ugh.
See, whereas I have a bit of a soft spot for it. I like bad low-budget things.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Jack does, like, with his B-movies as well, and I get some of the charm of it, I suppose, but not a lot. Did I send you the link, or the recommendation for the weirdest fucking movie I've ever watched part of? The Mexican Santa Claus movie?
No, but I need this in my life.
Oh, I must have told Callum and Becky. It's called The Devil Versus Santa Claus, or Santa Claus Versus the Devil. Okay. Devil, and it's like a 50s Mexican film. It is the creepiest fucking thing, and it's so weird and awful, and you and Ben will love it, so find it.
Okay, beautiful. I will look that up.
Well, and I'll link it in the show notes.
I'll wait till you link it in the show notes.
Sorry, everybody.
I'm so excited for this. The other thing I really liked was the concept of anti-noise, the idea that silence isn't the opposite sound, it's its absence, but this is the sound that lies on the far side of silence.
The same theme of
coming out the other
opposite. Yeah. It's extreme.
It's shadowy decibels throttling the market cries like a fall of velvet, which is a beautiful sentence. But I like it. Yeah. Pratchett plays with that theme a lot. It's something I was saying to you, I can't remember if this was during a recording or not, about how for a while I was really stressed out about the pandemic and work and everything, and then I kind of came through the other side of stress.
Yeah.
Which is still kind of where I'm at. It's like the thing I was talking about, I think, in one of the more episodes where I was saying, like, there's a moment of zen I get in the kitchen where there's tickets spewing out the rack and I'm trying to do a million things at once. And it's like everything kind of stops because it becomes you can only do one thing at a time. It's like that bit in Over the Hedge where the really hyperactive squirrel drinks the energy drink and then like everything's in slow motion around him.
I know what you mean. It's like when people said like near-death experiences and that, and time slows down and you've suddenly got time to react to all these things. It's like the bodily reaction to incredible amounts of stress is to put you into this weird zone.
Yes. But so I like the concept of anti-silence being more than the absence of sound. Dead Arch Chancellor's Francine?
Oh, yeah. So the hat's full of him.
Yep.
200 to be precise. Set me a wondering briefly. Because as we found out last book, there's about 2,000 years since the founding of the university, which means that with 200 arch-chancellors in the hat, the average reign of an arch-chancellor is 10 years, which is, depending on how you look at it, quite long or quite short.
Well, considering the Debris pointy shoes tradition.
Quite, so I think it must have probably been like dragged upwards by a few long-standing ones. Quite like the British monarchy, which the average British monarch reign from 1702 to 2019 is around 26 years.
Well, I'm assuming Liz has kind of dragged that up a bit.
Liz, Victoria and George the, I want to say the third.
George the third was, he was the mad one.
Like 50 odd years, yeah. And then Victoria and now Queen Elizabeth broke the record.
Over 60 now. Over 60 years. I like that you did maths for the podcast.
Only a bit. Well, actually, I did write down and find out the average of those ones, but the 200 into 2,000 didn't challenge even me. So
I was having fun with percentages the other day. That's for bread making.
Ratios.
But so yes, 75% hydration for my dough, etc., etc.
Oh fuck yeah! No, this is why I stopped sourdough before I started. Everyone was like, "Oh, you gotta have 93%." Fucking hydration. I'm like, what does that mean? Fuck off. No.
So my starter is 100% hydration, and the recipe I've been using for the actual bread is 75% hydration, but with
I still don't know what that means.
Basically, the amount of water you use is 75% of the amount of flour you use, roughly.
So how is your starter possibly 100% hydration?
Oh, so 100% hydration means it's 50-50 flour and water. So there is the same amount of flour as there is water.
Oh, okay, got it. I still don't want to do it because the one time I've tried to play with very, very wet dough, it just went awfully wrong and messy. And
I'm still having trouble with...
I don't have a machine.
The mixing it by hand's not so bad. I'm having trouble with, once it's proved, getting it out of what it's proved in to bake because it's so wet, it just kind of flops. I can't shape it nicely, so I think I'm going to get some rice flour and a proper proving basket.
Yeah, in the meantime, if you kind of... You can... get grease paper and make kind of little walls to put next to it.
Yeah, I might try that. I proved
I just saw that on Reddit.
Yeah, rice flour is the thing that's been recommended because the dough won't absorb it, whereas if I line something with normal flour, it sticks.
Smart. So you get a little skin. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Anyway, sorry, moving on from bread.
How do we keep going on to bread?
Because like I'm in isolation and that's everyone is doing sourdough right now. Like,
yeah, it's like that whole
it's the current hot.
If your friend starts getting really into bread, they're depressed. It's like, yes, that's true, and everyone is depressed. And
yeah, the current hot isolation trend is sourdough. I think the next one is going to be either banana bread or head shaving or both.
Oh, I'm really good at banana bread. Okay.
I'm thinking about shaving my head.
I don't think I can pull off a shaved head though, so I'll go with the banana bread. You can do the head shaving.
I can't.
I'll bring the banana.
I can't pull off a shaved head anymore, but I want to get rid of all the bleached stuff. And I figure if I shave it while I'm in lockdown, then I've got plenty of time for it to grow back before I have to leave the house and deal with people again.
Mm. Mm.
So it's tempting. Anyway, on to the bigger talking points. Ipslaw's absolute fury at mortality. You're not a dick like Ipslaw, but it did sort of make me think of you a bit. In that you're constantly looking for ways to, you know, get out of the meat prison and make sure you have immortality. Mm-hmm. And Ipslaw is...
Do not go gently into that good night.
Yeah, and Ipslaw does not go gently and eventually manages to...
He does not.
...put himself into the staff.
Good lad.
But I just thought it was...
Maybe this is why I liked him.
Considering this is within the first 15 pages of a comedy fantasy book, it is such a deep and dark conversation... of Ipslaw being absolutely furious at death, furious that he was punished for feeling love, furious at losing his wife. And the way he says it to death is in, you took his mother.
Mm.
And of course, death doesn't take anyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good setup for much later. It explains the anger behind everything later and why Coin has been pushed the way he has and...
And
it's very clever, I think.
And the way sort of death is the one positive Ipslaw has is children are our hope for the future, and death kills that. He says, no, there's no hope. It's just me.
Cheery, cheery death.
But this Ipslaw is a guy who has had so much power. It's like you were saying, there's something likable in the fact that he's allowed his arrogance because he's so much more, he's kind of deserving of it because he is so much more powerful. And it is this guy who had this power, had this love and managed to have 8 kids with her. He loved her enough to run away from all tradition. And tradition is hard to run away from. The fact that he's so powerful and he's so passionate to get to the end of his life and to be so bitter at the loss of his wife and being sort of left holding the baby. And it's an interesting motivation for him because he's partly motivated by this desperation for immortality and to show the world how great magic can be. He's talking about Coin, his son, who is obviously a babe in arms at this point. He shall show them what lies in their deepest hearts, their craven, greedy hearts. He will show the world its true destiny, and there will be no magic greater than his.
Yeah.
To have all of them.
Like, I'll fucking show them, except it's like the ultimate living vicariously, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like...
Well, he blames the wizards so much for the death of his wife, because he's saying, you know, part of what killed her was the fact that they were almost hunted. And it's like, mate, it might have been the 8 kids, because I'm assuming the... depending on where you're hanging out, the protections for childbirth aren't great, unless you've gone to the Round Tops and checked in with, like, Granny Weatherwax or someone.
Yeah, but I think he also has a fair point.
He does also have a fair point. So I think it's a really interesting character, considering he spends most of the book as a stick. As much as I called him a dickhead, and I still maintain that he is a total dickhead, I don't dislike him as much as I dislike Drum Billet, who, for some reason, I just irrationally
As they say, great men aren't always good men.
Yes.
And he is a very interesting, powerful, good character. A good character, not a good man.
It's a well-written character.
Yes.
But it just puts me, goes back to the constantly being in awe of Terry Pratchett managing to put this amazing philosophizing about mortality and destiny at the beginning of a parody fantasy novel.
And cats are nice.
Which just hits at the perfect, that's such a good comedy moment because it just hits at the perfect part of the ranting.
Yeah.
Speaking of the end of the world, Francine. Animals.
Animals fleeing it. A bit less serious than yours. So there's, as you referenced earlier a whole bit where the various vermin of the Unseen University are fleeing because some shit is going to go down. And this is referencing a very common
phenomenon.
A commonly cited phenomenon, not so much as a common one. As you quite rightly say, so the obvious one is kind of the rats fleeing the sinking ship, which is referenced, as I'm sure you know, in The Tempest.
It is. I knew that.
Shakespeare's The Tempest, Act 1, Scene 2. In few, they hurried us aboard a bark, bore us some leagues to sea, where they prepared a rotten carcass of a boat, not rigged, nor tackle, sail, nor mast. The very rats instinctively had quit it. Which betrays a certain lack of understanding of what actually happens with rats leaving a ship. unsurprisingly, the rats leaving a sinking ship phenomenon is indeed a real phenomenon. You get hordes of rats leaving ships before the people know it's sinking quite a lot. That is often the alarm. But that's because the rats live in the bilges and in the very bottommost parts of the boat that aren't often reached even by the crew. And so they get wet first. The other kind of part of this is the idea that animals have this sixth sense that they can tell when something's about to go down. So like the lead up to the Sri Lanka tsunami, the Boxing Day tsunami, mm-hmm. there were a lot of eyewitness accounts of, for instance, elephants screaming and fleeing to higher ground. And it's quite often portrayed as animals having a sixth sense that we don't have, which is pretty pseudo-scientific. There's not a lot of it doesn't make a lot of sense that humans are the only species that have lost this ability,
yeah.
kind of thing. However, what does make sense is the idea that some animals might have a bit more warning than we do. So rats, I mentioned elephants and rats getting their feet wet first. And I mentioned elephants and tsunami because elephants can hear a lot. Elephants and whales hear lower sounds than we do.
Oh, right.
So rumbling and that might reach them first. Same as dogs hear higher sounds than we do, and there might be some kind of ultrasonic things in various disasters that set dogs off barking before we notice what's going on, like storms and things.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there are any disasters that affect the magnetic fields of Earth, but if there are, that would fuck with birds.
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming, particularly in the case of the Unseen University, there is a lot of low level background magic and everything's probably just a bit psychic. Exactly. Like the gargoyles knew that the sorcerer was coming.
Yeah. I'm using this as an excuse to talk about something related.
I know.
I'm not trying to
I'm not yelling at Terry Pratchett soon. Yeah. No, it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But actually in the case of the Unseen University, the fact that the rats and mice are going and that, if there's some weird vibrations magically through the building's probably a bit scared, isn't it?
Rincewind says,
and they are living in the foundations of the building, and they'd be like the first ones to be unsettled by the mood of the building changing.
Rincewind says at one point that he can feel the building shaking, and I think that's almost like a shiver of fear going through it. That's interesting though. Thank you.
That's okay. Anyway, elephants. I like them. I like excuses to talk about them. I think they're really neat.
I did like you shoehorning elephants back in again.
Did you know elephants can smell like the amount of something in a closed container?
What?
So you or I could tell that this container has garlic in it by sniffing it.
Yeah.
An elephant could tell if it was full of garlic or had a bit of garlic in.
Had
one clove of garlic or five.
Yeah. Cool. Elephants are awesome.
Elephants are really good at smelling. Elephants are awesome though. They are.
I'm starting to get a bit concerned because I think by the time you're 30 you have to have an animal that you're into, and people buy and everyone has that. Yours is obviously elephants.
Yep. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it, to be honest, because you get nothing else but elephants.
But I think and everyone,
it gives people an excuse to buy you things for your shelves, which I can see are full.
Yeah. Everyone has it though, and if you don't make it known that you like a particular animal, it becomes another friend of ours has owls as their thing. Mm-hmm. But I feel like if you don't pick one for yourself, one gets randomly assigned to you. And I'm 27 and people keep buying me unicorn themed stuff. And I love my unicorn slippers, but I also never thought of myself as particularly unicorn-y. And I'm worried that my assigned animal that people theme me gifts around has become unicorn against my will.
Do you have a favourite animal?
I like a lot of animals. I really like wolves. I was very excited about wolves, but I don't like wolf.
Yeah, it's kind of wanky to have a lot of wolf stuff.
Yeah, no, that's like sad for you.
Get you a fleece with a wolf on it. Do you want that? Do you want that?
No, that's what no.
Yeah, don't let people know you like wolves.
I like otters, but they were kind of my mum's thing, so that's more of like a family. Yeah.
Oh, you otter following her footsteps.
Oh, Francine. So yeah, so I'm slightly worried that my assigned animal has become unicorn. And I don't know what that says about
me. Oh, well, it could be worse, could be worse. At least they're pretty things, usually, unicorn-y things. Yeah, like, shimmery.
I do like glitter.
A bit extra. Yeah. I think probably what it says about you, Joanna, is that you are a practical worker type who is also incredibly flamboyant.
I mean, my husband has the same problem. Like, his thing is dragons, but he is actually genuinely really into it. And there's a lot of dragon statues in my house now. Crows, corvids, that needs to be my thing.
Corvid, yes. Get in there.
Sorry,
crows.
Yeah, no, I just like it to be known that like my thing is crows. Buy me crow stuff. Although, you know, if anyone who's bought me unicorn themed things are listening, I do like those as well. That's fine.
Maybe yeah, I'll take out the bit where I call them all wankers.
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks.
Multiple times a show, I have to take out bits where I call people wankers.
That's fair. I cannot segue from that to this. I'm not even going to try. The idea of the
what's the next bit?
Fierce middle.
The fierce. Come on, you can do it. You can do it. I believe in you.
So I need to find some middle ground.
Now a unicorn has a fierce head. What I want to talk about is the fierce middle. The thorax of the unicorn, if you will.
Unicorns don't have thoraxes, Francine. They're not insects.
Wait, is the thorax the tail?
No. It's the...
It is the middly bit, yeah.
But
okay.
Not insects.
Shut up. Very don't well. Argue with my entomology. Finally, I get to use that word.
Loving that the past few weeks mean I finally know how to say epidemiology.
Your lifelong dream, finally.
Have an excuse to use epidemiologist in a sentence. Anyway, the fierce middle. So we were talking about what level wizard people are. Carding is an 8th level wizard and Spelter is like 5th level.
Yep.
And there's the idea that Carding has become quite complacent because he's been on the top for so long, whereas Spelter is in the middle. By then, all the no-hopers, the lazy, the silly, and the downright unlucky have been weeded out. The field's cleared, and every wizard stands alone, surrounded by mortal enemies on every side. Pushy falls below, waiting to trip him up. There's the arrogant sixes above, anxious to stamp out all ambition. And the idea of when you're halfway up the ladder, it's the hardest place.
Yeah.
Especially when you look at the concept of class and middle class being comparatively quite a new concept.
Yeah.
So we've talked about this a little bit before on the podcast, I think, where like it's the kind of middle class levels where people get very obsessive over things like manners and propriety. Because once you're upper class, you're sort of rich enough to do what you want. And if you're working class, it's almost not worth a bother. This is a huge simplification of a very, very overcomplicated class system, especially in England, which is weird.
And I'll take this chance again to recommend the book Watching the English by, I want to say, Kate Fox. Because it has a fantastic in-depth explanation of all of that.
But it's really fascinating across cultures watching a middle class emerge. Obviously, it's fairly entrenched into British culture now, where maybe it wouldn't have been 300-400 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's more recent in, say, Chinese culture, which had this huge economic impact of as the emerging middle class became a bit of a thing. This is a huge, again, huge simplification. Meat became more consumed and beef consumption shot up massively.
Mm-hmm.
All due to an emerging concept of a middle class that hadn't really been there 100 years before.
Mm-hmm.
So I've liked the idea of it. Obviously, it's not class here, but it is wizard class.
Yeah.
The idea of...
A bit more murder.
Yeah. The middle section being the hardest and most ambitious place to be,
yeah,
because it's always easy to be complacent at the top and you're just sort of trying to survive at the bottom. I thought it was really interesting, and I like that it's the basis of Spelter's character,
yeah,
and that makes how he progresses in the book quite interesting compared to Carding, who is a complacent top level wizard who basically looks for ways to maintain a status quo that benefits him.
It's a bit political. I mean, I assume Pratchett's thinking behind it was politics rather than class, although I like your class comparison. That's a good one.
I mean, it did also make me think a bit of the thick of it. Anyway, celibacy, Francine.
Yes.
I'm not segueing into celibacy.
Good. I think Ben would be upset. So wizards and celibacy is something that was covered in earlier books, and usually in fantasy, as in the earlier Discworld books, it's kind of explained away as sex drains power, or women corrupt powerful things.
Yeah, we are evil.
You know, vague sexist undertones, the usual. So I quite like the fact that Pratchett has introduced a practical reason why celibacy is so encouraged.
Because otherwise you might get sorcerers.
Yeah, basically. Don't breed because you might accidentally have 8 kids twice. And now look what's happened. But I like that it also, it mirrors some other religious beliefs. And by that I mean it was put into place for a good reason in the time period, but then kind of folk beliefed into having another reason.
Yeah.
So like you to massively oversimplify this, like let's go to the Bible with shellfish.
Yeah.
Don't eat shellfish because like, and it's been theorized that that's in there because people kept fucking dying of shellfish and kept up with and kind of retconned by followers because they don't want to admit that this is no longer relevant or needed or whatever. Although actually it was shellfish. People don't seem to care so much as they do about gays. So
that's good.
Whatever that is. It's almost like it's just an excuse to be shit to people.
Yeah, entirely possible.
While also enjoying crab cakes.
Crab cakes.
Yeah, the last talking point on there is yours. And it's yours talking about, you've like picked the two that really I should have picked up on and didn't, which is Rincewind's character development and Ipsilor's mortality.
I'm interested in Rincewind's character development because I sort of had in my head I don't really enjoy Rincewind books, and you talked me around to him in Colour of Magic and Light Fantastic, but it means I'm more I'm more interested in him as a character now. And you know, we've talked a lot about enjoying his casual nihilism. He decides he's not going to help. This is right at the end of this section, which, just in case we didn't say, ends up top of page 95 in our copies, with the Rincewind stared at the smudge on the horizon and sighed, "Just talking to myself," he said. So we end with him arguing with his conscience. But this is, the hat's been kidnapped from the boat. He is still on the boat. And he says, "No, I'm not helping. I'm letting it go." And it's, he was making a decision. It was his. It belonged to him. No one was forcing him to make it. Sometimes it seemed that his entire life consisted of getting into trouble because of what other people wanted. But this time he'd made the decision and that was that. And of course, this doesn't hold true. He gets into an argument with his conscience. By the end of the book, he's agreed to go to Al-Khali. By the end of the section, which is a page later, he's agreed to go to Al-Khali and look for the hat. But Rincewind has so little agency in his own story.
Yeah. Yeah, always. Yeah, that's kind of his thing, isn't it? He's buffeted about on the winds of fate.
But to have attempted to claim a bit of agency here and to lose it immediately because of his conscience.
Yeah.
To get to, and I'm mostly making a point of this now because I want to come back to it in part two and part three as his character develops. He's claiming agency here, and he eventually does get to claim agency in a really different way by the end of the book. And he gets to make a decision, and it is a decision he makes for himself.
Yeah.
Admittedly, because of his conscience and centuries of tradition piling down on him.
I do remember
that. I thought it was interesting to point him out here because of what's going to happen to him in the long run.
Yes, very good. And it is always nice to see Rincewind have an internal crisis to go along with his external crises.
I do enjoy him arguing with his conscience. It makes me laugh. Right. Do you have an obscure reference for Neil, Francine?
Oh, I do, yeah. Just a brief one. There weren't really many references as such, so as I've done a few times now, I've just picked up on a word I didn't know the meaning of. When they're describing the library, they mention the tomes, and Incunabala is an early printed book, especially if printed before 1501.
Ah.
So it is a very, very old book. It's one of them.
Cool. I learned something new. I'm excited by this.
You did. Every day's a school day.
Brilliant. So that's section one of sorcery. We'll be back next week with section two, which is running in my copy from page 95 and starts with Carding surveyed the hat critically. He walked around the table and stared at it from a new angle. At last, he said, "It's pretty good. Where did you get the octuaries?" And we're going from there to page 180. You mean heights, said Konina. And stop being silly. I know what I mean. It's the grounds that kill you.
Yes.
So, thank you for listening. Do we have anything else to say before I do an outro?
No.
Cool. That was a lot of build up for it, yeah.
I was thinking. I wasn't trying to be suspenseful.
Oh, I got very excited there.
That's just how I breathe.
Thank you for listening to The Truth Shall Make You Fret. You can follow us on Instagram at The Truth Shall Make You Fret. Find us on Facebook at The Truth Shall Make You Fret. Follow us on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod. Email us your thoughts, castles, albatrosses and snacks at thetruthshallmakeyoufretpod@gmail.com. If you're struggling with lockdown for any reason and want support, feel free to reach out to your lovely hosts on Twitter. I'm at Joanna Hagen and Francine is at Francie Bambi.
Yay.
And in the meantime,
I will actually make time to respond to you if I see it. So I could probably install Twitter back on my phone and everything.
I might.
I could do that. Yeah. I guess until next time, Joanna.
Don't let us detain you. I'm hoping he gets squished.
Man, he really held a grudge.
I know. Well, he was just such an obnoxious tree.